The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello! And welcome to the Pet Cause edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. I'm Felix Salmon of Fusion. I'm joined here by Slate Moneybox columnist Jordan Weissman.
Hello.
By Woman About Town, Anna Szymanski.
Hello.
Who sadly is not going to talk about anything emerging market.
Well, no.
We probably will. There will probably be something emerging markets in here, but we will, yeah. We will talk about more wonderful things this week. We're going to be talking about, this is great, I don't know if you've heard about this, but the city of Portland has decided to divest from all corporate securities. We're going to talk about what that means because it's kind of awesome. I love it. We're going to talk about the second coming of pets.com.
No sock puppets.
And there were fewer sock puppets, but like...
more money. A lot more money.
Yes.
And what this means about the... In terms of the retail apocalypse. Have you heard about the retail apocalypse? There have been big articles about the retail apocalypse all over Bloomberg and elsewhere. So we're going to talk about the retail apocalypse. But first, Anna, this is the story which we had like requests coming in over Transom. Can you talk about this? My favorite person in the world, Paul Singer, who's completely insane, is a good friend of ours. Yeah, I guess we have to talk about emerging markets, don't we? Because
right, you can't say Paul Singer and not say Argentina.
you can't say Paul Singer without mentioning Argentina. This is the guy who famously, you know, basically extracted billions of dollars in money from Argentina in a decade-long court fight. But he doesn't just fight countries.
No, it turns out.
He also fights this company, which used to be called Alcoa and is now called...
Well, this is actually a segment of the company that has been spun off, the aluminum parts manufacturing for aerospace and automobiles, the kind of higher margin, higher growth segment.
So Alcoa used to just make aluminum, and now it's two companies, yes. One which makes aluminum and one which makes things out of aluminum.
Exactly, which is run by Klaus Kleinfeld.
Or was run by Klaus Kleinfeld.
Still
this is the guy
recently.
Who got fired from Siemens for under some kind of a
bribery
cloud.
Issues.
And has now been fired from Arconic. As yes. It's known.
Wait, is that back when Siemens was literally like stuffing cash in drawers for people to go and bribe third world like bureaucrats?
It's a large German company. What can we say?
Yeah. Oh, this I didn't realize he was part of that whole Michigas. Okay, anyway, sorry. Yeah. Continue.
So Alcoa is a great American company which used to be run by our former finance minister Paul O'Neill. But it was run by a German because we were all good globalists around these parts. And it was run by this German who was very good at making things because Germans are great at making things. And sadly for Klaus, while he was presumably quite good at making things, he was quite bad at making the stock price go up.
Yes. Apparently he was spending too much time at Davos, too much time with Trump, not enough time meeting profit targets or dealing with competition from the Chinese aluminum industry. But most importantly, he recently sent a pretty fantastic letter and an Adidas soccer ball to Paul Singer.
We need to back up a little bit here. Paul Singer runs an activist hedge fund called Elliott Management.
Yes. They do other things as well.
And one of his activist stakes was in Arconic.
Exactly.
He was looking at Klaus and saying, Klaus, you're spending too much time in Davos and palling around with Donald Trump and not enough time, you know, making the company's share price go up. So we want you fired. We want the board replaced.
Yes.
We want to come in here and shake things up.
Right. And the board and the company had been, up until very recently, supporting Kleinfeld. But then this past week, this letter emerged where it's a very, very bizarre situation. But the letter suggests that Singer was engaging in some, I quote, lastingly legendary partying in 2006 at the Berlin World Cup, involving singing in the rain in a fountain, and a Native American headdress is somehow involved.
I have the letter up. Do we want to like read a little bit directly from
flavor? So the letter...
it's almost like he's talking about like this apparently Paul Singer showed up at the World Cup and just went hog wild, or that's what it's suggesting. And there's something that he's almost, Klaus is going to reveal,
right,
some compromise.
It's like an innuendo that, yes, he will like release this information to the public. It's suggested.
Okay, so Jordan, like, let's have a little excerpt of this letter. And I'm going to preface this by saying I have met Paul Singer. He is very boring.
And yet this letter makes him sound like just fucking life of the party. But anyway, I'm not going to do a German voice. I thought about doing a German voice, but anyway.
But you, in your mind, imagine like Hans Gruber from Die Hard.
Yeah.
And when Alexander saw the breadth of his domain, he wept, for there were no more worlds to conquer.
Anyway. It was much to my delight when I recently learned from Berlin what a phenomenal soccer enthusiast you must be. Quite a few people who accompanied you in Berlin in 2006 during and especially after the many matches you attended are still full of colorful memories about this obviously remarkable time. It indeed seems to have the strong potential to become lastingly legendary. Wow. Like, imagine like tinted fingers and like
and
a
then
chuckle.
He goes on in this vein, and there's some vague like mention of an Indian headdress. It's kind of insane.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. The P.S. If I manage to find a Native American Indian's feather headdress, I will send this additional essential part of the memories. And by the way, Singing in the Rain is indeed a wonderful classic, even though I have never tried to sing it in a fountain. Sorry. It's so weird.
It's so weird also because, like, Singer is the head of a $32 billion fund. He is not involved in most of the day-to-day investments. So it doesn't even make any sense why the letter was sent to Singer. Like, that's the whole thing makes no sense.
Unless it was like literally like he was like doing hookers after these matches, and that's like what he's hinting at. But like, what could, like, singing a fountain? That's only going to make people like him more.
More, exactly.
and Paul Singer receives this letter with glee, immediately turns around to the board of Arconic and says, "Do you realize what your CEO is doing in a period of drunken craziness?" And the board says, "We totally support our CEO's strategy and our plan, and we don't really believe in anything that you say, but yeah, you're right. This letter was a bit too much." And they fire him.
Yes. Suggesting that apparently they did have a point all along.
Well, that do they? Because, like, Elliot's reaction to this has been fascinating. Elliot's reaction has been, yeah, okay, fine. You know, we got this guy fired because he was really stupid and wrote a stupid letter, but the board is still saying that his strategy was right and his strategy wasn't right. Have they achieved something?
Well, again, so much of their attack on the company had been targeted to Kleinfeld. I mean, granted, it's part of a larger strategy, but he was the kind of embodied that strategy. So, and with a lot of activist hedge funds, they tend to focus on CEOs. So getting the CEO kicked out and then potentially getting Larry Lawson, who they want to have a CEO put in, we still don't know if that's going to happen. But that could potentially allow them to put forward their entire strategy and get that share price up in theory.
So this actually kind of, there's sort of a bigger question this story kind of brings up and I want to ask you guys about, which is why guys like Paul Singer seem to be so damn effective at what they do. Because, I mean, this is, you know, in the end, he got rid of the CEO. He succeeded. And then if you look at the econ research, right, the kind of finance econ research, what they found over and over again is that, you know, there are multiple kinds of activist investors. You have like pension funds, right, who often own like a big share of a company or a few pension funds own big shares of a company, and they'll get together and try to do something where they pressure the board to make changes in the way it's managed. And then you have these guys like Singer who are hedge funds who take up a large share and like, you know, an aluminum maker or some such thing, and they try to pressure changes at the corporation. And what they find when researchers look at this, they find over and over again is the hedge funders are just better at it. And they are more skilled at getting higher returns than compared to other people who try to go in and somehow pressure companies. So why is it that the hedge funders are so damn good at this? Why are they better than the rest?
So if you're looking at a hedge fund, alternative investments in general, most strategies have much more concentrated portfolios. So you don't have as many investments, which means you have the time and resources to devote to individual investments, as opposed to real money guys, your pension funds, your endowments, your mutual funds, who have hundreds and hundreds of investments. So even if they have some bigger positions, at the end of the day, they do not have the time and resources to devote in this type of action. Also, they have a different client base, or the resources.
So I mean, I think this, it really does come down to money. You know, if you look at how much money Paul Singer spent fighting Argentina, it was hundreds of millions of dollars. And any mutual fund who spent hundreds of millions of dollars on lawyers fighting one of its, you know, own positions would, you know, there's just no way that you could get that through compliance.
No, it's also, it's a different client base. If you're looking at who's investing in alternative investments, and granted, you do now have a lot of institutional investors like endowments, pension funds, investing in alternative investments. But in general, the clients that are investing in a place like Elliott understand that they're going to be engaging in this type of action. Whereas individual investors investing in a mutual fund or just an endowment themselves, it's a completely different client base that doesn't have the tolerance for this type of activity long term.
And also, I feel like your comparison, you know, you can say that pension funds are activists, but really, are they activists? No, they're not really activists. They might come out and have a quiet, you know, word in the CEO's ear saying, I think you should have more women on the board or something.
Right.
But that in terms of like wanting, they don't generally go in with the expectation of getting money by making change. If they buy stock in companies they like, not in companies they don't like and want to like.
Right. They tend to be passive, which I also then think raises another question of why we have such negative connotations of activist hedge funds. Like, if these funds are essentially the only people holding corporations and management accountable, why do they still continue to have such negative reputations? Well, aren't they doing what we want them to do?
Well, I think I can answer that just like the, you know, the PR problem they have, which is that you've got guys like Carl Icahn who are famous for just demanding money, right? That's, they demand payouts when the company has too much cash lying around.
Well,
and some people, there actually is something to be said for that. Sometimes the money is just sort of sitting there and not doing anything. But I think that, you know, people see that and they think, well, couldn't that cash be spent better on investing or in research? And at the same time, there is evidence that companies that get targeted by activist hedge funds do tend to cut things like R&D spending. The question is actually whether or not that is really hurting them. Sometimes that R&D spending wasn't really helping them either.
So, I mean, for me, the problem with activist hedge funds is really what you might call a duration mismatch. That I think of someone like Dan Loeb, and what he'll do is he'll take a big stake in Yahoo, he'll throw out the CEO, he'll replace him with someone else, and he'll persuade the new CEO to do, you know, to basically, you know, say that she'll spin off the Alibaba stake. And there's all manner of, you know, financial engineering going on. And then he gets what he wants. The share price goes up and he sells his shares and he leaves. At which point, Yahoo is basically a basket case. He doesn't care. He's not a shareholder anymore. And the idea that you can waltz in, dividend yourself out a huge profit, leave a smoldering wreck behind you, and go on rinse and repeat is... You can see why that leaves a bad taste in people's
mouths.
Right,
but are they leaving smoldering wrecks behind them?
Have you seen Yahoo?
Right, I realize Yahoo is one bad example. But if you look overall at companies that have been targeted by activist funds, usually 5 years out, they have better performance.
So one of the interesting things that also came out this week was an article in The Atlantic by Frank Partnoy and Stephen Davidoff. And they were like, hey, why don't we try and be activists? Just the two of us law professors. And I like them both. They're good guys. And they found this tiny little company in Southern California, which owns a bunch of land. And they reckoned that the market capitalization of the company was much lower than the value of the land. And so there was an arbitrage there. And they had bright ideas of what the company could do to improve its share price. And they tried to activist and, you know, spoiler alert, they failed. But like, it's a great article. It's a fun read. And I think, again, what you saw there was a duration mismatch. So what they wanted was a short little bump in the share price on the grounds of, like, you know, the share price representing the value of the land, whereas the people who are owning that stock are basically owning it as a proxy for owning the land. And they know that at some point, you know, some gazillionaire is going to come along and buy the company in order to buy the land for some vast amount of money. And they're not going to try and rush it. And they're happy to sit there and twiddle their thumbs until it happens. And it's just, it's a question of, do you have patience or do you not have patience?
Well, I was going to say, you know, their point at the end of that article is that this company was not just kind of lazy and not really moving quickly, but it just wasn't very transparent, and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't sharing information with shareholders. And their conclusion is that more of these small companies could use impatient, you know, activist investors, and they're never going to be targeted, because those aren't the sort of corporations that attract attention from people like Paul Singer for the most part. They go
well,
for
I mean,
fish.
Like Herbalife wasn't, that wasn't huge.
That's true.
Yeah,
but that's
still a bigger company than like Tejon Ranch. I mean, no, going back to what you were saying in terms of this duration mismatch, I mean, I think, though, that's suggesting that there is no connection between increasing short-term efficiencies and long-term profitability. As though, I do understand that often when you're thinking about hedge funds, or if you're thinking about like private equity firms, which is a different issue of coming in and actually buying out, that, oh, they're just completely destroying long-term value. But there, and sometimes that can be the case, but sometimes that's not the case. And sometimes it can be the case that, in fact, these companies are being poorly run. They are paying their CEOs too much. They aren't using cash efficiently. And these companies, these funds can potentially come in and force them to engage in changes that can affect long-term share value, and also, frankly, help your real money investors, like your pension funds and your mutual funds, that don't have the ability to do this, but they also... They
get to be free riders.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
So I want to continue here on this question of activism, because there are various different types of activists. There are the hedge funds, as we have talked about. There are the pension funds who are better at free riding than they are at actually making change. And then there are our favorite, like, you know,
singing grannies.
I was going to say Park Slope Food Co-op types. You know, having huge fights about whether you can sell hummus. And the spiritual center...
Why could you not sell hummus?
No, this was actually... Wait, have you never heard about this?
I have not.
The great... it was over Sabra, right? Yeah. It was about, you know, Israeli settlements or something. Anyway, and don't go on. Anyway,
so, well, yes. Well, this is part of it. There's this thing called the BDS movement, which is a big thing where you can't invest in Israel so long as it's, you know, settling Palestine. There's a bunch of other companies which are considered to be beyond the pale, including obviously tobacco companies, firearms companies, energy companies. The list goes on. Caterpillar was on the list for reasons I can't remember. I'm sure we're all boycotting United Airlines right now, and on and on and on. And the spiritual home of this kind of, like, it's unethical to invest in everyone from ExxonMobil to United Airlines is, of course, Portland, Oregon. And Portland, Oregon has a $1.7 billion investment fund, you know, to pay its pensions and whatnot. And the Good Burgers of Portland, Oregon turned up one day and said, here's our list this week of the companies you can't invest in. And the investment management team in Portland, Oregon said, listen, every time we come back here, you give us a new list of companies we can't invest in. This is becoming unwieldy and unmanageable. And we were okay up until now, but we can't go on like this. And they came up with the most glorious solution to this problem that I've ever heard, which is they said, okay, let's just not invest in any corporate securities whatsoever. No stocks, no bonds from any corporation anywhere in the world.
Yeah, I would just like to say that if I were a Portland taxpayer, I would be quite angry at the clear violation of fiduciary duty of the people running this fund.
And I'm going to take the other side of this. And I'm saying that the fiduciary duty is not the same thing as maximizing returns. And that if your client, which is the city of Portland, wants you to invest a lot, you know, in accordance with certain ethical principles, then all power to you. You should do that.
So I'm going to take a middle ground here and say, I don't know if I'm really for or against this, but I think it's going to lead to like some hilarious outcomes somehow. Like, on the one hand, they're definitely going to lose money. Like, you can take that for granted.
Well, I will push back on that.
Okay. Unless they go for, so they're not going to invest
should see the look that Anna just gave me.
So here's the thing. They're not going to invest in corporations. Typically, that's kind of a drag on your portfolio.
A little bit.
However, this could lead to some crazy situations. Like, well, there's sovereign debt. So I almost imagine a situation here where, like, the investment fund of Portland is just going to be lending money to, like, the South African government in some chase for yield. Like,
pretty sure it's domestic munis and federal.
It's not munis because...
That's true, that, yeah.
The only reason you invest in munis is for tax purposes.
This is my
insight here.
Okay.
This is like, so Anna's 100% convinced that this is going to cost a significant amount of yield or return or whatever you want to call it.
Because I can add.
Jordan is more or less convinced as well. So I'm going to try and take the other side of this one and say there's another way of looking at it. $1.7 billion is a lot of money. The corporate part of that $1.7 billion portfolio was about 30%. So it wasn't a huge amount to begin with. It's not like they're changing the entire thing. They're keeping 70% of what they had. And so the question is, if you have 30% of your portfolio in like risky stuff, interesting stuff, which is meant to be like boosting your returns, where do you invest it right now? Is overheated public equities the smartest place to invest it? Is,
I see where this is going.
You know, is overheated bonds the smartest way to invest it? Or if you're coming at this from a more ethical point of view, maybe you could start doing some interesting things in, say, impact investing. Maybe you could start doing some interesting things in like real resources, like low-income housing or timber or, you know, sustainable, you know, energy or various other alternative assets which aren't necessarily just buying and selling stocks on the stock market. And if you do that, there's a good chance that, you know, if and when the Trump crash happens, you will look really smart.
How do you do impact investing or like alternative energy investing if you're not going
investing
to touch
in corporates? Also, I would argue that impact investing tends to overweight small cap growth stocks, which are probably some of the most overvalued right now. So I think the argument that by moving your money out of corporate bonds, especially very low risk, currently low yielding corporate bonds, and putting them into small cap growth equities in a moment when the market is frothy and thinking that you're going to have better returns.
So impact investing in my mind never includes buying securitized equities on the secondary market. The buying securitized equities on the secondary market just is never going to have an impact on anything. Now, you know, I will agree if there was a criticism here, which I haven't heard, like, you know, divesting doesn't make any difference. Like, it's true. Divesting doesn't make any difference.
We're all taking that for granted at this point.
But by the same token, investing in some like already issued equity, whether it's a small cap stock or anything else, also doesn't make any difference. So that's not impact investing. You're not going to have an impact by investing in a small cap growth
stock. So you think venture capital here or something like that?
So yeah, I'm saying like you can buy equity.
Isn't overvalued?
you can buy equity, but what you're doing is you're structuring investments in certain companies directly into that company. It's always primary deals. So you could call it private equity if you wanted, or you could call it structured finance, or you could call it, there's a whole bunch of things which involve a combination of debt and equity and real assets, and which are designed to have, you know, the term of art among these people is double bottom line investing.
You could also call it quite risky investments. And I would argue,
yes, and this is the 30% of your bucket, which is allocated to risky investments.
But it's not allocated to risky investments. If you looked at that portfolio, those were very low yielding, short duration investments.
And you can do this in debt instruments as well, which is, you know, I can give you a risk profile from alternative investing and impact investments and real assets, which is almost identical to the risk profile you had in bonds and stocks.
You're looking at bonds that were yielding not that much more than the treasury.
Right.
So you're not going to be getting it wouldn't make any sense to go into alternative investments, VC, where you're taking on tremendous more risk for that type of return.
Venture debt or, you know, there's like, I'd say real
assets.
Right, but
the whole point is you're going to be expecting a much higher return because you're taking on significantly more risk. And my guess is, I don't know what Portland exactly uses its money for, if this is to just offset like pension liabilities, or if they have a longer term investment horizon, so they have fewer liquidity needs, so then they could take on more risk. But I would imagine, just looking at the structure of their portfolio, they cannot take on tremendous risk. So it wouldn't make any sense to me to go into alternative investment classes, which are far more liquid, far riskier. That doesn't seem to make any sense to me. I don't disagree that ethically there could be an argument for it, but in terms of your fiduciary duty as an investment manager, that doesn't make a lot of sense.
I hate it when people, like, I just wrote about the Ford Foundation going on about fiduciary duties. This idea that there's this mythical thing called fiduciary duty, which prevents you from investing in according to the ethics of your client, is complete bullshit.
Well, it's also a little tricky when you're trying to figure out what your duty is to the city. My guess is that the raging grannies who showed up to sing a protest song at this last meeting, and that's actually what they call themselves, the raging grannies.
From Standing Rock to Palestine, and here in Portland town, human life is under attack, and the right thing must be done. Which side are you on?
This is Portland.
Because this is Portland. They were wearing funny hats because I don't know if any had a bird on it. But probably decently represent the views of their fellow Portlandians. However, when you're making an ethical call as running an investment fund for a municipality, it is a little bit, it's tricky. What is your duty period? I don't know if how you measure that outside without something like a vote or something formal.
But I think there was a vote. And I think that, you know, while getting some kind of combination of risk and return is certainly part of what an investment manager's job is, I think it is not true to say that that's the be all and end all. And then in any way you kind of deviate from your risk/return mandate is a violation of your fiduciary duty. I think that's just not true at all.
I think there is certainly a smarter way to, obviously there's a smarter way than what they did. But in terms of saying, okay, we want to meet a certain return target because as a city, we have certain things, services, affordable housing that we'd like to pay for. So we need to earn a certain amount of money to pay for that. Okay, how can we earn that money? Well, maybe we can do some research into certain corporations or whatever that we could potentially earn that same amount of money, which is not at all what they did.
Yeah, I think you kind of articulated what I was trying to get out much better. But you have a bunch of activists who are angry about corporations, but it's not clear if they understand that, okay, we may be sacrificing some returns and that might hurt our other priorities. We may be making a trade-off elsewhere. And cities do have responsibilities for things like affordable housing and such. So it's hard to say, what is your fiduciary responsibility? Like, there are things to weigh here. It's not just about appeasing a few activists who show up and get pissed off about you investing in, like, a coal mining company or something.
And we will see. And I guess the big question, everyone is trading this as a trade-off. You know, is it worth losing a certain amount of return in order to be ethically happier? And I think a lot of people in Portland would say, yes, it is. And they're making that trade-off quite consciously. And then I'm just going to say, as a provocation, that maybe it's not even a trade-off at all. And maybe they're not even going to give up return.
So just to recap, Anna wants them to drop what they're doing and just invest in companies. Felix, you want them to become a $300 million venture capital fund for alternative energy. And I want them to start lending money to Venezuela or something just for the hell of it, to see if they can get high yield that way.
It's essentially an oil company. Yeah,
and prove their lefty bona fides by supporting socialism directly.
The socialist oil company.
Yeah, that's what we each think.
Or just lend the money, you know, to people building affordable housing in Portland. Keep it local instead of throwing it to the New York Stock Exchange.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
Let's talk about the retail apocalypse, which, Jordan, you think doesn't exist.
It depends which retailer you're talking about, which kind of retailers.
I've been reading these articles about how the workers in shopping malls around the world, or at least around the United States, you know, the employment is down 20%, that it's mostly women, that no one knows or cares about these people because they're mostly women, and that the number of losses in retail, job losses in retail in recent years is like 20 times bigger than the number of job losses in coal mining, but you never hear about it. Is this true?
So, I mean, there definitely is a sector of retail that's in trouble. Department stores are very, are ailing. They're falling apart. Macy's is not doing well, and, you know, Sears is not doing well. And there definitely are retailers that, you know, I think there have been 9 retail bankruptcies in 2017. I mean, this is not...
Neiman Marcus is for sale.
Yeah. I mean, they're troubled. But, you know, I think you have to separate the entire, you know, you'll see a lot of these articles that say, oh my God, retailing is falling apart and 1 in 10 American workers are in retail. And you have to separate the department stores, which, you know, really are kind of falling apart. If you look at this, a sector called general merchandise stores that the government tracks, I think they've lost like 100,000 jobs in the last few months, which is quite a bit. You have to separate that out from the greater retail sector, which is seeing sort of which includes things like auto dealers and clothing stores, et cetera. And that is essentially seeing a small dip in jobs that is not really apocalyptic. So you do have one sector of retail that is being kind of eaten alive by online merchandising. Essentially, it's being eaten by Amazon. And, you know, that is something to take note of. But at the same time, you know, whether or not that really has profound consequences for the economy at this point isn't totally clear.
Well, I mean, let's put aside the economy. Let's just like stick to profound consequences for the people who work there. Like if you have a job in a department store, your employment is precarious. We have seen this movie before. Ask anyone who used to work in a bookstore 20 years ago. Like these jobs can go to zero.
Right. But are those people just unemployed or are they going into another job? I guess this would be my argument, because even though we're seeing some of these numbers, it's not as though we're seeing tremendous, in fact, we're seeing decreases in unemployment. And granted, I realize that at this point, we don't know this specific segment of workers, which jobs, whether or not they're able to shift into another job. But there is also an argument to be made that as some of these low paid, low skilled retail jobs are going away, there are other jobs, often, unfortunately, low paid, also low skilled, that these workers could shift into. And I don't
think,
what we're seeing in a lot of malls, where you're seeing a lot of the decline of some of your traditional retail stores, you're seeing the growth of hair salons, nail salons, fitness centers, entertainment centers, this kind of more the shift to like experiential retail. And essentially, it's often the same skill set. So my question is, are we actually seeing an incredible increase in unemployment among these workers moving forward?
Or are they just getting jobs?
Exactly. I don't know. I haven't seen that data, but I think that's it's a question to raise.
Yeah. And there's been this sort of political meme going around, which is, you know, Donald Trump cares so much about coal miners, right? And retail is so much bigger than coal mining. All these retail, you know, jobs are disappearing. And why don't Republicans care more about retail jobs? And, you know, in the end, it's because retail typically isn't the main economic support for, or A, it's not the main economic support of a community. There is no, like, Poughkeepsie is not, you know, balanced on retail. Like, there's no West Virginia of retail. But beyond that, also, I think these jobs, these jobs do tend to be more transient. People move in and out of them. That's one of the defining things about the retail workforce, is that people shift from job to job. And so when one store closes, it might not have the same devastating effect on a quote, career.
I like this idea of sort of velocity of employment. That coal mining was a low velocity industry where people would stay there for decades, and retail was a high velocity industry where people would normally, even in the boom years of department stores, not stay working for the same department store for that long. And that if you're going to be moving on from that job anyway, then the idea that the total number of jobs in that store or in that industry is going down is going to be less harmful.
Yeah. Right. And it's just culturally so different. I mean, you hear these stories when people talk, and granted, coal miners are a very small segment of the economy. There are more yoga instructors in America than there are coal miners. But coal mining represented something culturally to a lot of people, even though these weren't particularly fantastic jobs for many reasons, black lung least among them. But it did represent something, whereas that isn't, you don't have the same cultural associations of working at Sears. Whether you should or you shouldn't, that's a larger question, but you don't.
And but let's move on to the news hook here, because because this is, I had a little poll on my Twitter feed this week. I said, has anyone here ever heard of Chewy.com? Chewy.com. And 70% of the respondents to my highly scientific Twitter poll said, who, what? No, never heard of it. And I've been talking to other people, you know, around town and saying, have you ever heard of Chewy.com? And pretty much that seems about right. 70% of it, people have never heard of it. And it's a retailer. And it's a retailer that most people have never heard of. And yet it is being bought.
Yeah. So
for
Chewy, reportedly, according to Recode, it was PetSmart purchased Chewy.com for $3.35
billion. $3.35 billion. That's more than Jet.com sold for.
Yes. This, if true, this would make it the largest e-commerce purchase ever. And what you neglected to mention, Felix, is that Chewy sells pet supplies, like dog food, then things like that.
We all learned during the dot-com crash in 2000, well, at least those of us who were, you know, alive. I think Jordan was in diapers or something.
Yeah. Actually, my fifth grade class did have a stock picking. My fifth grade math class had a stock picking project. So, and I might have invested in Pets.com for all.
But there was this generally accepted idea that, like, Pets.com was the ultimate dot-com bubble bad idea, and like it made no sense to sell cat litter over the internet, because by the time you paid to ship it to people, it cost vastly more. But anyway, somehow Pets.com was a really stupid idea which deserved to go to zero and did go to zero, and Chewy.com is worth $3.5 billion.
So there are two ways to think about this. There's the Mark Andreessen point of view, right? Which is that, you know, he likes to argue that every idea that went bust in the early 2000s, every dot-com idea that we laugh at, was actually a good idea that was just before its time. This would seem to be the ultimate indication thereof, or the biggest vindication of his perspective. However, assuming that this $3.35 billion price tag is true, and some people have contested it and anonymously said actually it's inaccurate, but let's take for granted that it's true. You could just say we're looking at a highly inflated market for startups, and with way too big valuations, and at the same time you have this retail apocalypse happening. So you have companies like PetSmart freaking the hell out and saying we have to pay top dollar just so that we don't get eaten by this competition.
And I would actually argue that these are really connected too, because I would say that it's not necessarily the retail apocalypse, as well as instead the retail shifting, that you have a lot of traditional bricks and mortar stores that understand that they're going through a very expensive transition. And it makes more sense often to buy another company that's already doing something well online, as opposed to trying to start that in-house. But in order to generate the cash to buy that, you often have to close things like unprofitable stores, which is what we're seeing happening. So I think these ideas are very much connected. But I would also agree with you that I think that it remains to be seen if this isn't going to be another cautionary tale down the line, because the type of growth we've seen in Chewy.com is pretty remarkable. Granted, it's only been over 5 years. And I would argue, I don't see how this growth possibly continues. This is a company that doesn't make any profits, which I realize that's always the case with a lot of these tech companies. But this, I mean, they have a lot of revenues, but they don't make any profits. And if you look at the type of pet food that they've been making money on, it's just very expensive. This is a really niche market that I don't know. And it's primarily been New York and California. I don't know how you expect, because also part of the reason that they've been able to grow is because they have great shipping and great customer service. Can you scale that?
Yeah, that's the thing. The big difference between Chewy.com and Pets.com, and the big difference in a lot of these businesses, is that Pets.com was basically built on UPS and the USPS, whereas Chewy.com and the sort of second and third generation retail startups are saying, no, we are going to invest huge amounts of money in distribution centers in Brooklyn and in Oakland and places like that so that we can get people stuff ourselves very quickly. But as you say, you know, that's great if you live in Brooklyn or San Francisco, and it's not so great if you live in Boise.
Yeah.
But this is my favorite data point. I need to throw in the data point here. We look back on the dot-com bubble as the time of, like, max crazy. And I think in many ways it was, certainly if you look at the NASDAQ stock market. But my little quiz for you two is, at the very, very height of the dot-com bubble, when Pets.com was trading at its maximum amount, what was the market cap of Pets.com?
Okay, so I know the stock went up to like 15. It disappointed from the outright. Like, it never... Because Pets.com debuted and, like, immediately started falling because already people knew it was in trouble. But, like,
I don't know.
I'm gonna give, like, let's give it.
I was pretty young into.
Yeah, I was like 2 years out of that fifth grade stock picking class. Project. Let's say it went to 900 million. Let's say sub a billion.
So you think it was less than Chewy.com, but sort of within the same neighborhood?
Yeah.
Like, Anna?
I would say, yeah, maybe around a billion.
Around a billion? The answer is the maximum ever market cap for Pets.com was 300 million. It was
serious?
Less than a tenth what is that of what Chewy.com
what
is
What is
worth.
That adjusted for inflation? Still, not, yeah, it's like, it's not.
Well,
it's not going to get.
Okay. Not much, yeah.
Which just, like, you know, goes to show how everyone says that the private markets are the new public markets, but just that really brings it home that we're not even talking the amount of money that Pets.com raised in the stock market. Mm-hmm. We're talking about the entire market cap is less than many capital raises that you're seeing these days from, you know, the big private companies.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Okay, let's have a numbers round.
Okay.
My number this week is 37%, 0.37. This one came out from a Pew Research poll, and it was looking at internet use around the world and in developed countries where basically everyone is online. And in fact, the idea of going online is something which is... It doesn't even make any sense anymore. We're always online. Our phones are always connected. Our computers are always connected. It's not something where you need to like press a button and dial up and go online. But the one thing which you do need to actively do is call up Twitter, call up Facebook. You do go on Twitter. You do go on Facebook. So what you can do is you can measure how many people go on social media. In the United States, it's 69% of Americans like use social media. In Germany, it's 37%. That's my number. It's 0.37 Germans, or 37% of Germans actually use social media at all.
I wonder if they live... I kind of am envious of that.
Interesting. I wonder if there's like a demographic reason, or if there's also...
Or they actually like, read books instead. I like richer, more intellectually fulfilling
lives. Klaus Kleinfeld would suggest that may not be the case.
Wait, unless you consider sending a soccer ball in the mail to be social media.
It's analog social.
Anna.
My number is somewhat of a sad number, I'd say. Well, it's 3.8%. That is Turkey's current account deficit. Your current account deficit is essentially a measurement of whether you're a net debtor or a net lender. If you have a deficit, that means you rely on foreign capital to meet your domestic consumption and investment needs. Point of this this story is that I think that this is right now the only thing standing between Turkey and total authoritarianism after last week's referendum result, where Erdogan essentially... Now, has his executive presidency, has tremendous powers, and what we've seen in the last year in Turkey is really, truly devastating. But because their economy is still heavily reliant on foreign capital, that hopefully will somewhat restrain him in the way that other countries like Russia that have a much different they're not as reliant because they have a lot of natural resources. It's quite different. So although I am concerned about the market's ability to restrain some of these strongmen, I'm hoping that this will help somewhat moving forward.
I was going to say, we just did an entire episode about how the markets fail at this job consistently.
Yes, I know. And this is what I was thinking. But I will say, recently at my last job, every time Erdogan did something, he would then send out Mehmet Simsek as deputy prime minister to essentially calm the markets, which to me suggested they would have these investor calls and he would do this little dog and pony show, like nothing to see here, folks, which suggested that he still understood that at the end of the day, maybe there's only so far he can go. And as I've said, from what we discussed last week, this is a big concern I have, but I'm hoping it restrains him somewhat.
Well, so I'm going to come up with the second number, which is 2 million, which is the number of Venezuelans who came out on the street to protest Nicolas Maduro. And it's looking very much right now. Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela, is in his sort of Bill O'Reilly mode. He's going to be out any minute now.
So he's not going to get $25 million.
He's probably got more than
probably
that.
Probably get far more from FX arbitrage. You make a lot of nice...
But yeah, I feel you're absolutely right. Sooner or later, Erdogan is going to wind up on the receiving end of the popular opinion, which he still weirdly is on the beneficiary end of right now.
Well, just like, I mean, it's interesting because it's an urban-rural split.
Oh, totally.
So in a way, that disadvantages him because it means that all the angry people in the cities can show up in the city streets and start demonstrating. Whereas if your supporters are...
In Anatolia, it's a little different. Yeah.
Just Bloomberg just had a piece called The Bond Market Prefers Dictators to Democracies.
Right. Although, again, I'm not saying I necessarily agree with this, but a part of the argument is that now that we have the referendum result and he has his executive presidency, was essentially all he's been working towards, people think now he may actually pull back. Because the argument is, this is all he's been working towards. So even though he'll make some noise about the death penalty, all these things, that this actually...
He's like Hank Paulson. If you give him a bazooka, he'll decide he doesn't need to use it.
Exactly. That is, I think, what the markets are actually pricing in right now, which I have no idea if that's actually accurate or not. It most likely is not. But...
One can hope.
Yes.
So what's your number?
My number is $400. This is the best story of the week.
Is this about juice?
Yes, this is. So I wanted to make this a whole segment, but we're going to reserve it for the numbers round. So $400 is the cost of the Juicero juice making machine. Juicero is a very hyped startup that has received over $100 million in venture funding. And its promise was it was going to make it was going to be the Apple of cold press juice. It was going to make this machine that just made fabulous, fabulous juice for people who had the money to blow on it. And it, like, apparently the machine was able to like put 4 tons of pressure on these bags of juice materials that were, you know, and that was going to get the like perfect squeeze. Why I'm bringing this up this week is because Bloomberg had a fantastic article where they discovered that you could just take one of Juicero's juice bags and using your bare hands squeeze it and get basically the exact same result as the $400 machine.
The same amount of juice in the same amount of time. Although given that you can only get the bags if you own the machine, I'm not sure how this actually helps you.
Well, so I think it just so this is a question, right? Like if you are so determined to get Juicero's juice, will you still pony up for the $400 machine just so that you can get the bag? You know, I think that the halo of bullshit around this company is going to be devastating. Yeah. It just knowing that you're getting ripped off, essentially you're getting sold pre-made juice.
But this is a discounted machine. It was $700. They've now discounted it to $400.
Yeah. And maybe they'll just switch it. It'll be like printers. All of a sudden they'll make the machine itself very cheap, but then the juice bags will cost like $400. Yeah, well, it'll be like your toners.
I mean, exactly.
And they will expire. This is my favorite thing about Juicero is that apparently it's a feature rather than a bug that if you put your bag in the machine and it's 1 day out of date, the machine will refuse to press it.
1 day.
But now we know that you can take the bag out and you can just press it yourself.
No, but I think you're right about they make this machine cheaper and the bag's expensive. That right. I can see it surviving because then the halo of bullshit disappears to some degree.
How cheap would the machine need to be in order for you to buy a Juicero machine?
I literally have put up I one time posted on Instagram a message said if anyone ever sees me buying $10 juice, they are entitled to shoot me with a dart gun and drag me out of the store. Like I have never, like, I just tranquilize me.
It is not difficult to buy $10 juice.
I know. That's what I'm
saying. They are everywhere in New York City, and there's this chain called Organic Avenue, which specializes in $10 juices, and which recently got sold by one private equity to another private equity company because they can't make it work. And it turns out that the number of people with that kind of disposable income to spend on $10 juices is maybe a little bit lower than we had suspected.
Perhaps. And going back, sorry, to our previous discussion, one of my favorite data points, or not really a data point, but at Chewy.com, one of their products that they sell is a $190 bag of dog food.
What?
It is a New Zealand lamb 8-pound bag of dog food that costs $190.
Wait, for 8 pounds of lamb?
Yes.
Wait. You could just buy the lamb.
you could probably buy more than one lamb.
You could just buy the.
I mean,
give it the meat.
I have a very lovely halal butcher on 9th Street in the East Village who will sell me 8 pounds of lamb for much less than $190, and I can guarantee you that my dog, my hypothetical dog, would prefer it to this
whatever you are buying. Yes,
that's amazing. Okay, I think that's it. On which note, if you have a dog you would like to feed some lamb, just let us know on slatemoney@slate.com, and we won't be able to help you because we are not going to send you a $190 bag of lamb from chewy.com. But keep us posted all the same, and if you do buy $190 bags of lamb, please write in and explain the logic. If you have a Juicero juicer, please write in and explain the logic, because it would be great if we could have like a call-in show next week from someone who has one of these things and goes, oh, well, yeah, juice. So yeah, keep us posted and listen next week where we will have an equally fascinating discussion, but not about juice. Many thanks to Zach Dinerstein for producing this week and all of the other production crew here at Panoply Towers, Steve Lichtai, June Thomas, Andy Bowers. All of the Panoply shows can be found at panoply.fm. Thanks for listening. Join us next week and subscribe. Just hit that subscribe button because it'll be even better next week. We'll talk to you then on Slate Money.